Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. COVID and race, how disparities in Alabama are highlighted by the pandemic as the state sees record numbers of hospitalizations. Then, forest under siege, illegal logging devastates the Congo Basin rainforest, an area of critical importance in the fight against climate change.
We will die and lose everything. Our children will suffer. They will die from the effects of rising temperatures and climate change. We must protect the forest from logging.
And it's Friday. Mark Shields and David Brooks examine the ongoing pandemic response, the president's threats against cities, and the race for the White House. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. The nation ends this week with 145,000 deaths to date from COVID-19 and infections spreading rapidly beyond 4 million. Still, the White House renewed a push today to see schools reopen this fall. Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany cited revised guidance from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
We believe that students should be going back to school because the effect on a child, we know scientifically, they are not affected in the same way as an adult. Again, I'd point you to CDC guidelines on this that says the best available evidence indicates if children become infected, they are far less likely to suffer severe symptoms.
President Trump had acknowledged yesterday that reopenings at some schools may need to be delayed. In another development, McDonald's announced that customers at all of its U.S. locations will have to wear masks starting next month. Officials in Seattle warned today against federal intervention in protests this weekend. A team of Custom and Border Patrol agents arrived last night to protect federal buildings without notifying local officials. It followed nights of violence and vandalism in the downtown. Mayor Jenny Durkan said today that federal action could incite new trouble, and she urged calm.
Don't take the bait. Don't buy into it. Be peaceful. If you come out in the streets and raise your voices, not only is it your right, but in many ways it's our obligation. But for those who are bent on destruction, those who want the fight to come, I say to you, stop.
Meanwhile, in Portland, Oregon, demonstrators massed again at a federal courthouse overnight. Some tried to take down a security fence, and federal agents again fired tear gas to disperse the crowd. The top federal prosecutor in Oregon said today that at least 18 people have been arrested in Portland this week on federal charges. President Trump's former personal attorney, Michael Cohen, was released from prison today for a second time. A federal judge had ordered him freed. He ruled that the government revoked Cohen's medical furlough earlier this month as retaliation for a planned tell-all book. Cohen was convicted of tax fraud and lying to Congress. China has ordered the closure of a U.S. consulate as a diplomatic rift keeps growing. The targeted office is in the western city of Chengdu. It's a response to the closing of China's consulate in Houston.
The current situation in Chinese-U.S. relations is not what China desires to see. The U.S. is responsible for all this. We once again urge the U.S. to immediately retract its wrong decision and create necessary conditions for bringing the bilateral relationship back on track.
Workers at the Chinese consulate in Houston loaded moving trucks today. They faced an afternoon deadline to clear out the complex. The State Department says that the consulate was aggressively spying and stealing COVID-19 research. And the Justice Department says that a Chinese researcher who allegedly concealed her military ties is now in custody in San Francisco. She faces charges of visa fraud. In Turkey, Muslims held Friday prayers at the iconic Hagia Sophia for the first time in 86 years. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan was among thousands who prayed at the 6th-century site. It was originally a Christian cathedral and then a mosque for centuries. It had been a museum since 1934. Back in this country, Hurricane Douglas is headed for Hawaii, leaving people to try to shelter and keep social distance at the same time. The storm could bring 100-mile-an-hour winds and 14 inches of rain to the islands this weekend. And in the Gulf of Mexico, Tropical Storm Hanna could become a hurricane before hitting Texas tomorrow with 4 to 8 inches of rain. And on Wall Street, stocks slumped in part over concerns about U.S.-Chinese tensions. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 182 points to close at 26,469. The Nasdaq fell 98 points and the S&P 500 slipped 20. Still to come on the NewsHour, illegal logging devastates the Congo Basin rainforest, critical in the fight against climate change. A new analysis shows control of the U.S. Senate is up for grabs in November, and much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
There's been a great deal of attention on the spike of COVID cases in states like Florida, Texas, Arizona, and California. But other states are struggling with it profoundly, too, like Louisiana and Alabama. Alabama doctors and nurses are seeing record numbers of hospitalizations associated with COVID, more than 9,000 as of today. The state has reported almost 1,400 deaths since the pandemic began, and there are nearly 75,000 cases. Stephanie Tsai has a report tonight on how the virus has hit especially hard in a county in the central part of the state and how huge health disparities among Black residents are leading to even worse outcomes.
A 90-degree July afternoon deep in Lowndes County, Alabama, is nothing like a walk around heaven. But the mourners came anyway, to pay their respects to a pillar of the community, dead at the age of 50 from COVID-19.
We're here for the ongoing service of Pamela Sue Rush, New Mount Lily Baptist Church, Hainesville, Alabama.
And I wouldn't get no heated stuff in the house. My daughter cried every morning and say it's cold in the house.
Pamela Rush was first featured on the PBS NewsHour in 2018 in a report on extreme poverty, showing the squalid conditions she was living in, no sewage system, and a trailer home she worried was making her and her children sick.
I need to, you know, get out of this house because the mold and stuff in there and it's bad on your hair.
Animals were getting in, she lamented, showing the trap cages.
So I got diabetes and I don't need to get back no animal.
She couldn't have known then that a much bigger risk lay ahead. The tragedy of Pamela Rush's life and death has deep roots. Her neighborhood was built on former slave quarters, and the abject poverty she experienced can be traced back to the legacy of slavery in the Southern Black Belt, so named for the fertile soil that lay the foundation for cotton plantations.
I was devastated.
Catherine Flowers is a cousin of Rush's and an environmental justice activist who enlisted Rush in her advocacy work.
Hi, my name is Pamela Rush. I'm from Lowndes County, Alabama, and I live in a mobile home with my two kids.
In June of 2018, Rush and others testified before a congressional committee as part of the Revived Poor People's Campaign.
They charged me over $114,000 on a mobile home that falling apart.
I was devastated because we did not get a chance to get her out of that trap that she was in and to let her benefit from the work that she had been doing all this time to move her family from the home that she was staying in.
Pamela Rush's is only one of the lives claimed by the pandemic in Lowndes County. Terrell Means is the county coroner.
My average calls a week will be one or two before the COVID and everything, but after COVID came, it started picking up 5 to 7 a week.
So far, 537 cases and 26 deaths from COVID-19 have been documented in this sparsely populated place of less than 10,000 residents. The virus has infected 1 in 17 people there, the highest infection rate in Alabama and one of the highest in the country. Like Rush, many people here have diabetes, which experts say puts them at higher risk of death from COVID-19.
Anyone in your family history of diabetes?
Yes.
Okay. Has anyone ever said whether you might be diabetic?
No.
Dr. George Thomas, the only doctor in the county, suspects 60-year-old Elvis Harrison has it.
We can let you know before you leave if you do have diabetes.
Harrison takes the test and gets results on the spot.
You are diabetic, okay, and we do need to start you on some medicine.
So I was kind of surprised that I did have it because I got rid of most of the cookies and I got rid of the candy. I guess I stick with the fruit.
Dr. Scott Harris is the state's top health officer.
Alabama is not the healthiest state to begin with, and our African-American population disproportionately suffers from a number of chronic health problems. And when they have a serious systemic infection, then it just makes it that much more difficult for them.
Throughout the nation, the pandemic has had an outsized impact on African-Americans. But in Lowndes County, history may help explain why.
This is a map that shows a pictorial representation of the 1860 Alabama census.
African Americans are represented in blue and whites in red.
So all of these blue segments here represent enslaved people.
Dr. Harris says if you look today at where the most people in Alabama have chronic health conditions, it matches where the most slaves lived during the 1860 census.
The legacy of these enslaved people in Alabama's Black Belt is still felt today in the health disparities that we have. The African American population in Alabama make up more than a third of COVID-19 cases, and they make up over 45%, approaching half of all deaths.
Founder of the Equal Justice Initiative, Brian Stevenson, says lingering trauma also affects health.
Lowndes County saw lots of Black people lynched, pulled out of their homes, beaten, tortured, drowned, hanged. And that creates trauma. It creates an emotional injury, a psychological injury. And then you combine that with a lack of employment, and then most critically, a lack of health care, and you make an already vulnerable population more vulnerable when it comes to COVID.
There's no hospital in Lowndes County today.
All the way from Selma Town.
And there wasn't one in 1965 when Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., the late John Lewis, and more than 3,000 supporters passed through on their way to Montgomery. But the gains of the civil rights movement have not reversed the downward trajectory in Lowndes County.
We have failed to acknowledge the role of injustice, inequality, and bigotry in creating many of the conditions that continue to make us sick.
But there are, finally, signs that times are changing. Since 1940, a Confederate monument had stood in the Hayneville Town Square in Lowndes County. It bore the names of Confederate soldiers whose families owned slaves, among them Pamela Rush's ancestors. In the wake of the protests against the killing of George Floyd, the monument came down in June.
To be quite honest, I never thought I'd see it in my lifetime. That history that that monument represented was very, very strong and represented the terror that was inflicted upon our family.
Terror perpetuated by systemic racism that put Catherine Flowers' cousin, Pamela, at great risk when COVID-19 came to Lowndes County.
And it's hard. I couldn't buy my children's stuff for what they need.
That soft-spoken voice in front of members of Congress somehow echoes louder in her passing.
I have to make sure that in Pamela's memory and for her children's future that we dismantle these structures that kept her trapped.
America's reckoning with racism will come too late for Pamela Rush, but perhaps it will arrive in time for Bianca and Jeremiah, left too soon without a mother. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Stephanie Tsai.
The Democratic Republic of Congo is a massive country, the size of Alaska and Texas combined. It's also home to a large part of the Congo Basin rainforest that is the world's second largest after the Amazon. It's the habitat for countless species and crucial to mitigating climate change as it soaks up atmospheric carbon dioxide. One of the major threats comes from illegal and uncontrolled logging. In partnership with the Pulitzer Center, special correspondent Monica Villamizar reports.
Pygmies have lived in the forests of the Democratic Republic of Congo for generations. After 5 years of campaigning, the village of Lokolama became one of the first indigenous communities in the country to be given titles to their ancestral land. In March 2019, the whole village celebrated when more than 20,000 acres of forest was handed over to them to sustainably manage. But the joy and dancing was short-lived. Fast forward to today, and village elder Joseph Bonkili says that the threat of climate change and widespread logging is ruining that dream.
We will die and lose everything. Our children will suffer. They will die from the effects of rising temperatures and climate change. We must protect the forest from logging.
The government of Congo DRC has a forest code that determines which trees can be cut and how many. But there is little enforcement. Despite international and national laws designed to protect the rainforest, from 2001 to 2018, Congo DRC lost 6% of all the forest in the country, an area similar to the size of Mississippi. Congolese environmental activist Irene Wabiwa accuses logging companies of abusing the system.
Many companies are using fraud to legalize what is not legal. What is happening on the ground is that these companies, they are coming using their own power and money. They get permits and they falsify, they modify it to get more volume of timber that they will cut.
So why do you think the government is not doing more? Who's responsible for this and why are they not doing enough?
Governance in the Congo is very poor. Corruption is very high. So when you have power, you have money, you can do what you want in the forest sector.
Greenpeace has campaigned against illegal logging for many years. It argues timber consumed globally should be traced to its origin. Normally, a system of marks ensures that each log that is cut down is accounted for. The marks mirror those at the stump and also have information about the location where the tree was cut. But Greenpeace says much of the timber leaving Congo is cut without permission and manages to reach the final destination with counterfeit marks or permits. We joined environmental activist Etienne Kaziraka on a fact-finding mission deep into the forest. Many of Congo's forests are only accessible by riverboat.
The reason why many African parks have been spared of logging is because the infrastructure is so poor that getting the timber out becomes very expensive. But this is not the case here in this part of the DRC because the Congo River is such a good means of transportation.
We arrived at a concession operated by the Congolese registered Bakri Bois Corporation. Kaziraka decided to visit the site now as he had heard that the timber workers were on strike and we could enter the concession. These places are normally guarded and off limits to visits from environmentalists and reporters. Licenses and paperwork are the only way to prove the timber is legal and that loggers are not chopping down trees that are too old, too young, or endangered. But Kaziraka says that he has rarely seen a company operate with a valid license in this area.
Do you think a lot of this is going on in the Congolese forest?
Yes, it's a major problem, not an isolated case. In other areas, it's even worse than here. The forest is being pillaged. No one respects the law.
What do you know about the paperwork this corporation has, for instance? Do they have a license to be cutting this wood?
They had a license to log here issued in 2018. It was valid for that year, but is now expired. But they still continue logging regardless.
The logs are tied together, forming makeshift rafts, and floated to the capital, Kinshasa. This is the port of Kinkole, one of the many hubs in and around Kinshasa used for processing rainforest timber from the Congo Basin. Many of these trees facing the chopping block are hundreds of years old. Local authorities check the mark on the timber to see that it corresponds with the right permit.
The log number, the owner's name or initials, the month and the log number, correct?
Baruti represents 300 small-scale loggers known as artisanal loggers. He says on average, people like him only cut down around 150 trees per year, while large-scale industrial loggers cut down tens of thousands. Under Congolese law, small-scale loggers are given a special permit to work in their local forests. But foreign companies are using these licenses to log on an industrial scale. Next to this port and visible from the air, there is a large timber mill operated by a Chinese company where hundreds of logs piled up. We were not allowed to film inside.
The Chinese logging company has pushed down prices so much that artisanal loggers like us can't compete. We can each only afford to float our logs downriver once a year, while the Chinese company brings in two full ferries of wood each week.
Widespread logging of the Congo Basin continues to go unchecked, and this trend of deforestation is set to go on with irreversible consequences. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Monica Villamizar in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Thank you, Monica. And for the record, the story was filmed before the pandemic. With President Trump trailing former Vice President Joe Biden in nearly every major national poll, Democrats see more opportunities for gains, not just in the White House, but also in the U.S. Senate. Lisa Desjardins zeroes in on the races to watch.
Republicans began the new year as the favorites, likely to hold on to the Senate in November. Just take a look at the Cook Political Report's Senate predictions from January, showing an uphill battle for Democrats. All of those red and light red states are likely or leaning Republican at that point. Yellow means toss-up. Again, focus on the red and the yellow. Now, look at the latest Cook Political predictions. Just this week, far fewer red, more yellow. The map is moving toward Democrats, with the exception of Alabama. Here to explain all of this is Jessica Taylor. She is the Senate editor at the Cook Political Report. Jessica, so excited to talk about this wild year in the Senate. Tell us what's happening.
So what we have really seen is the past few months, of course, everything has changed because of the pandemic, and we have seen really the political ground shift under Republicans and move toward Democrats because of that as well. So even we were beginning to sort of see some political shifts happening in March, but in the past 4 months, what we have seen is a map that is now drastically favoring Democrats. We now see Democrats as a slight favorite in order to flip the Senate, and that is because Democrats have expanded the map. You have Republican incumbents, and this is a map where Republicans are almost entirely on defense, except for that Alabama seat that you mentioned largely, and possibly in Michigan. But we now see states in toss-up like Georgia, Iowa, Montana. None of these we expected to be that competitive at the outset of this year.
You mentioned this is because of the pandemic, but it has to do with the president's response to the pandemic. Is that right?
It does. We saw, as President Trump's approval ratings have dropped, and as we see his standing in the presidential race, as it moves toward favoring Joe Biden, who we have as the favorite to win the presidential race right now in our electoral college ratings, that is very much hurting Republicans down ballot. And Republicans that I have talked to recently, they increasingly see sort of the Senate as their last firewall.
Okay, let's focus on some of these fascinating races. Let's start in Maine. Senator Susan Collins used to be the most popular U.S. senator of any party, or at least one of them. Now she is in the race of her life against Sarah Gideon. Tell us about this.
Susan Collins, I think, sort of embodies just how difficult it is to be a centrist in the Republican Party that over the past 4 years has drastically remade itself into Trump's image. She finds herself in real trouble, and it is because, again, there is no sort of centricism that you are able to carve out with Trump these days. You're either with him or you're without him. And that's a hard lesson she had to learn when she voted to confirm Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. She voted to acquit President Trump in the Senate trial. All of that has really energized progressives against her in the state. And I think it's chipped away at her, that sort of coalition of Republicans, Democrats, and independents that she had been able to build for re-election. And she faces a very tough challenge from State House Speaker Sarah Gideon, who has been drastically outraising her as well.
Let's try and get in a couple more races quickly. In Arizona, we've got another Republican woman with a big challenge. That's Martha McSally. What's going on there?
McSally is interesting because she is the incumbent, but she was not elected to this seat. This is the late Senator John McCain's seat. And so this is actually a special election that's being held. McSally was appointed to this seat actually after losing what was a very contentious race in 2018 against Kyrsten Sinema. And she is running against who even Republicans will admit is Democrats' best recruit across the board. And Mark Kelly, a former astronaut, the husband of Gabrielle Giffords, who is, of course, you know, very beloved in the state, too. So she has a very tough task. She has very high negatives still from that race. She had to move also to the right very much in that race in order to win a primary challenge. And she has not sort of been able to tack back toward the center very effectively, if at all.
And another race, North Carolina. Tom Tillis is the Republican incumbent. He's running against an Army reservist, former state senator, but he's relatively unknown, the Democrat. Why is this race even in play?
It is the nature of the state. Again, Arizona, that is a Senate battleground. So is North Carolina, a very close margin there in 2016, and is going to be one of the closest races this time around. Now, no Senate seat is attracting more money, more outside money than this seat from both Democrats and Republicans. It's going to be a battleground at the presidential level. It has a competitive governor's race as well. And Tillis is part of this group of freshmen Republicans that won in 2014, which was a wave year for Republicans. They took back the Senate then. And now, 6 years later, they're facing a very, very different political climate. And Cal Cunningham, a former state senator, a veteran, he sort of has that centrist, Democratic, blue dogish type profile. And that's one that they think can appeal not just to suburban voters, but possibly to rural voters as well.
Jessica Taylor, the Cook Political Report. I think we'll be talking to you some more. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Lisa. Great talking with you.
And thanks to both of you. And that brings us to the analysis of Shields and Brooks. That is syndicated columnist Mark Shields and New York Times columnist David Brooks. It's so good to see both of you. So let's pick up, David, with what we were just hearing about these Senate races moving in the direction of the Democrats. What is going on here?
Well, I would say among Republicans, what had been concern has now turned into full-bore panic. The president is behind by sometimes 12 or 13 points in the national polls, way behind in many of these states. And that was survivable if you were a Senate candidate maybe in 1980 when you had a lot of ticket splitting and you could run well ahead of the head of your party. That doesn't happen anymore. In 2016, there was basically no ticket splitting. If the president won in that state, the Senate candidate won. And so it's just super hard to win when your president is losing. I don't think there are any Republican candidates who have successfully found a posture how to be loyal Republicans and not totally Trumpists. And so you're not only looking at Arizona and Colorado, which seem gone for the Republicans, but we're talking about states like Iowa and Georgia. And if you know, those should be solid Republican seats. And it's just a complete collapse, it looks like right now in the polls.
And Mark, I mean, as Lisa pointed out, the year started out with Democrats worried and thinking they might not be able to take the Senate. Are you surprised at this turn of events?
I am, Judy. I'm surprised at a couple of things. David's right about Democrats being on the offensive and Republicans being on the defensive. But I guess what surprises me more than it should not surprise me is that this has been the pattern. When a president gets in trouble, his Senate colleagues face the same fate very often. In 2016, for example, every senator who won in a state that the presidential candidate of that senator's party carried. In 2008, when Barack Obama swept, only one Republican survived in a state that Obama had carried. That happened to be Susan Collins in Maine some three terms ago. And we saw in 1980, David mentioned 1980, 12 Senate seats switched. In 1980, giants of the Senate, George McGovern, Warren Magnuson, Frank Church, John Culver all went down that year. The Republicans won the Senate for the first time in 26 years. Why? Because the presidential candidate, the president at the top of the ticket, was just incredibly weak. Jimmy Carter was at 31% job approval in 1980. George W. Bush was at 25% job approval in 2008, even though he wasn't on the ballot. We had the financial collapse. We had Iraq going absolutely south on him. And so this is what Republicans face right now, is that same kind of climate. And that's why they're worried.
And David, it's interesting because as we just heard in Lisa's conversation, that these Democratic candidates they turn out to be candidates who are talented in an election year when people are paying attention to the challengers. So often it's the incumbent who's favored.
And so often it's the incumbent who has the money advantage. And that's often not the case right now. Mark Kelly in Arizona has twice as much money as the incumbent. You're seeing big fundraisers. The Democrat is running against Lindsey Graham, is raising huge amounts of money. So they're getting the money. But, you know, I think it's not even the campaign. So James Fallows once said that this year is like 1918 with the flu, 1932 with the Depression, and 1968 with a war. And so we have all of that all at once. I think it's just not an election like any other. It's just a much more intense political era, a much more revolutionary political climate. And it's in this kind of climate, if ever, it's unprecedented, so we don't know. I just think you're going to see something much vaster than we think in a normal political year, even when there is a wave.
And Mark, at the same time, the Democrats who are running, who are challenging these Republicans, have to be in a position to take advantage of what comes their way.
No, exactly, Judy. I thought the point in Lisa's piece that Jessica made that was so important is that nobody's been able to figure out how to distance themselves from Trump effectively. I mean, two leading Republicans who did distance themselves from Trump, Jeff Flake and Bob Corker, both found themselves on the outs. Bob Corker of Tennessee, Jeff Flake of Arizona, and outside the Senate. How do you do that? How do you walk that line? Richard Nixon used to say, you know, when say anything you want to other Republicans, say anything you want for me or against me, just win. There was a practicality about it. Donald Trump doesn't have that same approach. I mean, it's total loyalty to him, and which is coming with an increasing political price, as David mentioned, the numbers that are currently in polls.
And speaking of the president, David, what we're seeing from the president now, and we just yesterday announcing the Republican convention isn't going to happen anymore, at least in Jacksonville, the big event that they had planned. But you also have him being judged on an almost hourly basis by the way he's handling this pandemic. You have him sending federal agents into American cities and threatening to send them into more. I mean, that's the atmosphere. That's the political reality that this presidential race is taking place in.
Well, the loss of the convention is bad news for Donald Trump because he's behind and needs some event that can maybe shift the race, and he's down another one. So that all that's left is the debates. He'll give a speech, I assume, some sort of convention speech, but it'll just be another day at the news cycle. The violence in Portland is something I'm curious about. I think most people, I'm appalled to have nameless random officers acting like this is not a democracy, acting like this is some sort of fascist state. On the other hand, there is a lot of violence in Portland. And if you go on Republican newsfeed on the right side of my Twitter feed, it's all the violence of the protesters. And so Donald Trump has tried to recreate a 1968 law and order campaign. And maybe this will turn some minds about that. Maybe there'll be a sense of panic. I tend not to think that. The violence is not widespread. It's in one place. I think that the general trend, most people will look at that and say, are we turning into a police state? But that sense of we need law and order, I think that's the only way I see Trump appealing to some people who are genuinely scared, if they are genuinely scared, which I'm not sure about.
Mark, is that attack that could be effective at this time when the president is facing so much criticism for the way he's handled the pandemic?
Judy, he's dealing with a pair of deuces right now, if this were a poker game. I mean, he's playing what he can play, and that seems to be maybe had a, you know, a night to soul-to-soul meeting with Roger Stone after his pardon, or his commutation, I should say, and you know, was reminded of the best scenes from 1968. The reality, Judy, is crowding upon him. 39 states saw increases in coronavirus and the COVID-19 this past week. We had 4 million cases for the first time. And the one point where I've seen any Republican encouragement is that for the first time, Donald Trump seems to be taking it seriously. He doesn't do it well. He reads it. He cannot read from a teleprompter. No one's ever taught him how to do it, and it's not very convincing. But he had a week where he was at least addressing the gravity of the situation and acknowledging it, and acknowledging that in spite of the record heat wave in Washington and elsewhere in the country this year, that it's not going to miraculously disappear in hot weather.
And meantime, and just quickly, because I do, there's something else I do want to ask you both about, but you have the Republicans in the Senate unable to come to any kind of agreement, David, over what sort of relief to give the American people with these additional unemployment benefits about to run out. Could this be a political, serious blunder for the Republicans if they don't make the right move?
I think so. You know, the economic crisis is still ongoing, and the way we solved it temporarily was give people $600 checks, and now the Republicans either want to cut it to $200, which is an insult in a time of crisis, or Steve Mnuchin seems to want to reform the process of distributing the money in the middle of a crisis for bureaucracies that are barely keeping it together right now. And so it seems just like when Republicans have a complicated thought, they revert back to fiscal discipline. But this is not the time for that. They should be shoveling out the door in the nation's interest and, frankly, in their own political interest.
And, Mark, I do want to turn both of you in our final seconds here to John Lewis. Of course, the civil rights icon, someone who laid him his body on the line for what he believed in, who fought in his quiet way for civil rights his entire life. You had, you know, many occasions to be around him. What would you say about John Lewis?
Well, one of the absolutely disarming qualities of Congressman Lewis was whenever you ran into him, he'd just grab you by the hand and said, "Hello, my brother. How are you?" And I don't know, being called your brother by John Lewis was sort of special. And no matter how many times it happened. Judy, you put it best. Here he is, the 10th child of poor sharecroppers in Alabama, born in the segregated South. And he put his life, he put his body on the line. At the age of 23, he was at the Lincoln Memorial. He was the firebrand that they were worried about, speaking before Martin Luther King. 25, he walks across Edmund Pettus Bridge, seeking the vote, the right to vote that was promised to Americans and denied systematically by state after state, including his own. And he had his skull fractured, his body broken, but never his spirit. He was an incredible gentleman. He was an incredible leader, an incredible example. He left America so much better than he found it. And people talk about changing the name of the Edmund Pettus Bridge to John Lewis Bridge, which is fine. What they ought to do is pass a Voting Rights Act after the court decision in 2013, which naively thought this problem was over. We've seen the systematic denial of the right to vote, whether it's cutting polling places, cutting hours, purging of lists, IDs, voter IDs. And that would be the testimony and memorial to John Lewis, if appropriate, is a Voting Rights Act, a real Voting Rights Act.
Well, he will lay, people will pay his respects to him next week. His funeral is 1 week from today. Mark Shields, David Brooks, thank you both.
Thank you.
As we come to the end of another difficult week, we want to take again a moment to honor just some of the many lives lost to COVID-19. Rene Chavez had big dreams and an active imagination, said his wife, Annette. Passionate about the animated He-Man series from the 80s, Rene launched a successful podcast called Nerds on a Couch, where he and his friends discussed, debated, and reviewed comics. Rene even drafted his own sci-fi stories.
Hello, everybody. Rene from Nerds on the Couch here.
As a high school English teacher in El Paso, Rene would often loan his comics to students to encourage them to read more. Rene was 45 years old. Dr. Elise Galati was a spiritual person. Her pastor said she had a particular affinity toward people who felt left out. A psychiatrist and social activist in the District of Columbia, Elise cared for drug addicts and HIV patients. She helped finance students' educations and feed families in need. For more than 50 years, the mother of two served as an esteemed faculty member at Howard University's College of Medicine. Until her passing at the age of 91, she never gave up her passion for dancing. Ken Kirkman was a friend to all, but especially to the underdog, his family said. Ken, who was 74, and his wife Karen grew up on the same street in Salt Lake City and were high school sweethearts. During their 50 years together, Ken served in the Army and as a mortician during the Vietnam War. He was also a bishop in their church. The couple hosted countless family barbecues with their children and grandchildren, who love when their pop starred in their dance videos on social media. Renata McGuire was a devoted mother to the six children she leaves behind. Her oldest is 19, her youngest just 6 years old. The disabilities of two of her children inspired her to work with other children and adults in the disability community. Born and raised in St. Augustine, Florida, Renata's brother described her as fun-loving and generous. He said she loved to make people laugh and smile. Renata was 39 years old. Edna Raper, or Dolly to friends, was an outstanding Cherokee citizen, said the nation's principal chief. The 67-year-old was one of the few fluent Cherokee speakers in her neighborhood and known for making the best biscuits and fry bread. Kind and generous, Dolly never complained, not even while fighting breast cancer in her early 60s. The matriarch of her family, Dolly raised four children with her husband Frank in Oklahoma. They had 13 grandchildren and one great-grandchild. As protests and rallies against racism escalate throughout the country, Boston artist Robert Pro-Black Gibbs says rather than put his voice front and center, he'll paint the backdrop. In teaming with that city's Museum of Fine Arts, that's exactly what he's doing right now. WGBH's Jared Bowen recently joined Gibbs at the site of his latest mural to discuss the power of positivity in painting. The story is part of our ongoing arts and culture series, Canvas.
For artist Robert Gibbs, the routine is straightforward. Rise up and get rolling with music.
So there's songs that either I'm familiar with from listening to my moms and pops jamming on a Saturday, or things that I've grown up with just throughout all my life. Music is definitely a vital component to painting.
The lifelong Bostonian is working on the third mural in his Breathe Life series. Epic-sized works bringing fresh air into the city's Dorchester and Roxbury neighborhoods. Begun in 2017, they offer a narrative. First, a little boy with massive might. 2 years later, Gibbs painted him as deliriously happy, supporting his equally joyous sister on his shoulders. Now, in his latest piece, commissioned by the Museum of Fine Arts, she's floating into the world on her own.
She's blowing a series of bubbles, and out of the series of bubbles, there's going to be one of them that's big enough that covers and protects her whole entire body.
What do we see in her hair?
You see the universe, the galaxy. So the universe is always on our mind.
On his mind has been Gibbs's 2-year-old daughter, making sure that as she grows up in Boston, in these times, she has something to look up to.
It's an uplifting message. And so instead of trying to, as I would say, feed steak to a baby, I would sneak the pill in the applesauce. And so hopefully it's something that she grows up with and other little kids that see themselves in the murals.
Gibbs also grew up here, venturing into graffiti art as a teenager in the early 1990s.
It's just the ability to hack or manipulate the ideas from, you know, these little cans.
He stuck mostly to his neighborhood, mostly to buildings where he and fellow artists had permission to paint.
And these are areas of buildings that people or the city wasn't even caring about that we were putting the beauty in.
A creative innovator to his heart. His name is Raymo and his specialty is art on Beach Street.
Part of his inspiration came from movies that cracked open his view of the possible.
One of the films is Beach Street and then Star Wars. And there was brothers and sisters in there that looked like us. And I was like, yo, what they're doing is speaking for the culture in such a large platform.
Today, Gibbs's own platforms are expansive, too. Of course, there are the towering walls. But there's also Artists for Humanity, the institution he co-founded almost 30 years ago that puts under-resourced teenagers to work as artists. And now the Museum Commission, which also makes him an artist in residence. It's time to coincide with an upcoming exhibition of legendary street artist Jean-Michel Basquiat. But more importantly, says the MFA's Makiba McCreary, the museum is moving past a long history where local artists of color have often been left to the margins.
He's saying, I'm willing to be your partner in this and to be equals in this relationship, but really the gift is to us.
Why is that important to you, that it comes in that order, with that emphasis?
You know, black artists from Roxbury, from Dorchester, from Mattapan have not traditionally been acknowledged in our collection and in our programming.
The Breathe Life mural's timing is also horribly coincidental, as the killing of George Floyd has once again reminded the nation of the sanctity of breath.
In a state where we cannot breathe, I'm asking people to take the time to breathe and look at what's going on. People are walking around with their head down, angry, mad. And when you look at these murals, they're so large in size, it's a minute to take a breath and look up into what's promising, you know?
Already drawing visitors, the mural is painted on Gibbs's alma mater, Madison Park High School. A sentimental spot, but one that is also easily visible a mile away. And it's no accident that this girl floats over Boston Police Headquarters.
She's owning her place, her rightful place in the city, and you want everybody to see that, but mostly you want little brown and black girls and boys to see that.
They will also see, when Breathe Life is finished, Gibbs's signature, his artist name, Pro Black.
It's our name. Pro is for black is our people. And so that signature or the style or what people see alone and can connect with me as an artist, it speaks volumes, man, and it feels great. Because now, you know, I got my daughter telling me I'm a superhero to her now. So I'ma just continue to grow on and flow on, man.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jared Bowen in Boston, Massachusetts.
Regular viewers of the NewsHour know how committed we are to reporting on arts and culture through our ongoing series, Canvas. Well, this weekend, that reporting expands into prime time with a new series on PBS, Beyond the Canvas. My colleagues Amna Nawaz and Jeffrey Brown are here with a preview, but first, an excerpt from the debut episode. It's Jeff's conversation with music legend Bruce Springsteen.
Great singer has to learn how to inhabit a song. You may not be able to hit all the notes, that's okay. You may not have the clearest tone, you may not have the greatest range, but if you can inhabit your song, you know, you can communicate.
And Jeff and Amna join me now. Hello to both of you. So Jeff, you sat down with the one and only Bruce Springsteen, but it's just a sampling of the many conversations, remarkable conversations you've had with these artists that have made this the special portal that it is.
Yeah, that's right. That's right, Judy. I mean, that was, of course, a very memorable one. And just to sit with him and hear him talk about both the power of the music, but also the vulnerability he feels as an individual human being. He talked later in that interview about bouts of depression. And I remember being so moved by it. But, you know, it's not just the stars and celebrities like Springsteen and I travel. We travel around the country, all over the world. And I'm just so moved by the artists and the writers and the storytellers. You know, if you think about what we do every night in the news, it's in a way, it's the story of the day, right? That's what we're trying to do. Well, that's how I read novels. That's how I listen to music. That's how I watch movies. These are the artists, the creators who are moving us, yes, entertaining us, yes, but also sort of teaching us about the day and our world. And I love bringing that to the NewsHour.
And speaking of the world, you've done all this at a time of great tumult in the world, and you've brought that into your reporting.
Well, that's the world we're living in now, right? That's the news of our time. That is the story, the world of pandemic, the social justice movement that we're seeing. And we have moved and shaped all of our canvas coverage, really, to look at that. I can think of several stories just recently that meant a lot to me. I mean, one was about the power of the camera, the power of the image in the history of social justice movements, civil rights, and up to this time. And then one that aired even just this week, where we were looking at the impact of the pandemic on live music. And, you know, it's partly a business story. It's partly about the economics. But it's also really just about our culture and what brings us together and what we all do and how we create together and who tells our stories. So, yes, that's the story of our time. That's how we focused Canvas right now.
And Amno, what you're going to be doing with Beyond the Canvas is bring all this to a bigger audience, frankly, and the primetime audience that may not have had a chance to see these stories.
That's right, Judy. I mean, it's no surprise to you or any of our viewers. The storytelling on Canvas is unparalleled, right? What Jeff has been able to build, along with our colleagues Ann Davenport and Josh Barajas and so many others, it really does stand alone. It sets the bar for that kind of reporting. And that is why we are so excited to bring it to even more people and in a curated way. Every episode is a collection of stories, so people can kind of process them in a slightly different way. I mean, Jeff referenced this too. We can't ignore the fact we're rolling this out during a pandemic. I can't remember the last time I went to a live concert and sang with other people and danced with other people or went to a show and laughed and cried with other people. There is a void. There is a social and cultural void right now. We hope that this show will help to fill some of that. And I should mention, we don't shy away from the tough stuff. I mean, a lot of it is about what brings us together, the music and the art and the connection. There are real conversations about race and representation and identity, because that is where we are as a country as well. So we hope these stories meet the moment, but also help to move us forward.
And they come, Amna, at a time when people, I think, are hungry for content with meaning. And so when you say it meets the moment, that really is what this is all about.
I think that's right, Judy. I mean, it's both a reminder of the way things used to be, right? Everyone remembers what they felt like when they heard that Springsteen lyric or listened to that Reba song or watched Lily sing and had her make them laugh, or Steve Martin. These are all storytellers who are documenting our times. And I think when you pull them together in a collection like this, it really gives people the space to kind of process it. So we hope that it gives people something that they need, and we hope that they'll join us, and we hope we can make this Canvas community even bigger.
Well, we are certainly excited about it. Very much looking forward. Amna Nawaz, Jeffrey Brown, thank you both for all the work you've done on this.
Thank you, Judy.
Really looking forward. And you can watch the debut of Beyond the Canvas this Sunday, July 26th at 10:30 Eastern PM, 9:30 Central on most PBS stations. And there is more Beyond the Canvas online. Right now, you can read our full interview with musical duo Lewis York, featured in the Beyond the Canvas debut. They talk about why songwriting is so important in this time of crisis. That's on our website, pbs.org/newshour. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Have a great weekend. Thank you. Please stay safe, and good night.